The Guardian.
24 hours a day, 365 days a year, MI5's English language analysts listen to lawfully intercepted conversations, picking out essential information that will help us counter terrorism across the UK. They're the kind of people who don't miss a thing, who can listen for hours on end without losing concentration, who can pick out the important information and stay calm under pressure. They work well on their own, and even better when they're briefing the team on what they've discovered. If this sounds like you, visit the MI5 website to find out more and apply.
Hello, this is Politics Weekly. I'm Tom Clark. Deal or half deal? After Europe's leaders wedged in the matchsticks to hold open their eyes all night, they emerged into the grey dawn to proclaim triumph. The market soared, but already the doubters are starting to question the details. One way or another, we're still, in Chancellor Merkel's phrase, in uncharted territory. All in all, it's not the best of weeks for David Cameron to have had to deal with the biggest ever backbench rebellion on the EU. Where does it all leave the European ideal and the less than ideal situation on the government's benches? Well, joining me in the studio, we have Guardian commentator Anne Perkins, the New Statesman Raphael Baer, and the Guardian columnist Martin Kettle. A warm welcome to you all. Now, in times of economic hardship, it may not come top of everyone's list of priorities, but this week at least, we need to talk about Europe. Last night, EU leaders scrambled together a further deal to save Greece and Europe's banks from meltdown. Raphael Baer, you better bring us up to speed with what's going on in Brussels before we turn to the low politics of Westminster. What, in very broad brush terms, did they agree?
Well, the fundamental objective has always been to put up enough capital, enough cash, so that people think that Greece will at some stage be able to honour its vast debts. And this they've done by essentially jacking up the amount of money that Eurozone countries will collectively put behind Greece to somewhere towards 1 trillion euros, I think, which is a pretty large sum of money. It's not entirely clear exactly how they're going to do that, but they've said that's the target. So that's a big amount of money. Mm-hmm. Now, that's not enough, because you've then also got to say that the people that Greece owes, the creditors, well, they're still not going to get all of their money back. So they're going to take what we call a haircut, mm-hmm. essentially. It's a sort of partial default. Greece is only going to pay back basically 50% of a lot of that bond debt. Now, that then triggers another problem, which is that obviously a lot of the people who own these bonds, who have lent Greece money, are financial institutions. If they're not getting all of their money back, well, that creates a problem for them. So then you have this third part of the deal, which is that you need to make sure that banks and financial institutions have enough capital to absorb the sort of change in the way that all this debt is being structured. So that means they've agreed to basically put some more money into bank balance sheets, essentially another round of recapitalizing the banks. So you've got financial institutions need to be hosed down with a bit more money. The private sector creditors aren't going to get all of their money back, and the Eurozone members are just going to heap a huge mound of money onto the table and go, that's behind Greece, back off markets, we'll do what it takes.
So that sounds, at one level, very comprehensive, all the three legs being covered there, as you say, but there's clearly a lot of imponderables, aren't there?
Yeah. Like
you've already said,
there's a big problem in that. The promise of a trillion or so euros is easy to say when you're all sitting in a meeting room in Brussels. Actually, no one's got a trillion euros sitting around in the sort of Department of Euro bailout that they forgot about in their budget. So to get this money, you've still got to essentially go to financial markets. It's still borrowed money,
right.
But you have ways of leveraging what you've already got. And that means you have the countries in Europe that are still good for some money, essentially Germany, sort of showing its commitment and saying, well, we will stand by Greece, and we can jack up what we've got, borrow more, turn what is a pool of about 400 billion now, thereabouts, make it bigger.
Sounds a bit 2008,
yes,
doesn't it?
Yes, and the problem is that we've sort of been in this movie before, to the extent that Eurozone leaders get together, they realise it's a terrible crisis, something really must be done. They express enormous urgency and commitment to doing something, and at the end of that equation, a very large number appears and financial markets are reassured. And then it turns out that trying to get from that very large number on a piece of paper into very large amounts of money sloshing around the financial system, going into the pockets of creditors or going on to help the Greek budget, well, that's trickier than it looks, or sounds, rather.
So sounds, in terms of our question at the top, more half deal perhaps than deal.
That's my instinct.
A lot of imponderables in terms of, you know, whether the banks are actually going to agree to these haircuts, which are voluntary. And
if I just add one, the other follow-on problem from that is that obviously if they're taking a haircut in relation to Greece, well, then everyone who's lent money to Spain, Italy, Portugal will think, well, hang on, does that mean actually there's a haircut coming in all these other areas of debt? So you have your sort of moral hazard issue that then follows. And so containing the threat of, I mean, in terms of the threat of contagion, this could arguably make it worse.
Dear, oh dear. So I guess it was never going to be a easy morning. But let's just talk, Martin, for a moment about the quality of the statesmanship or statespersonship. We heard at the weekend there was a shouting match at the first summit, and then on the following day, I think it was, that the Belgian minister, finance minister, was reported to be sneaking off to watch the premiere of Tintin. And then the fist fight in the Italian parliament yesterday. You sort of think it'd be funny if it wasn't so serious.
Well, I think, you know, there's an economic real world, which Raphael's just been talking about, and there's also a political real world, which sometimes coincides with it. And, I mean, the problem, as I think Tim Garton-Ash writes in The Guardian this morning, is that, you know, you've got 27 different nation states with 27 different domestic political situations that have to be managed, often by governments which are in coalition, including here. Mm-hmm. So making an agreement which satisfies everybody is obviously A, very difficult, and B, going to fall somewhere short of the kind of ideal which would be which we would have if there were an enlightened dictatorship which would just solve the whole thing and tell us all what to do. We don't have that, happily. So, I mean, the politics of this, it seems to me, are that, I mean, at the heart of this is Germany. And Angela Merkel, again in a coalition, not doing well domestically.
Is she behind in the polls?
Behind in the polls, lost important state elections in the past year. So, you know, facing a general election in the not too distant future. So looking at a very difficult domestic political situation, she has to solve the problem, but not put so much money up front into the bailout and the recapitalization and so on, that the German taxpayer will just say, hey, hang on, I don't want to have anything to do with this. I'm going to vote for some other party. So it's a real big problem for Merkel. I think on the whole, this particular episode, she's come out of it quite well. In international terms, she's gone further than she's gone before. But, you know, she has to watch her back all the time.
The other figure who's been very much making the news in the last day or so is Silvia Berlusconi. And it seems to be a rather worrying feature of this deal that part of it hinges on Silvia Berlusconi honouring his word.
Well, that is a perennial problem in Italian politics and in European politics. I mean, the basic thing is that the Berlusconi government is a relatively strong government domestically at the moment, because the right tends to beat the left in most elections in Italy. But it is nevertheless presiding over a massive debt problem. I mean, and as we were just saying, there is a huge vulnerability of Italy, and Italy is the really big problem. Whether this is good enough, big enough, secure enough, convincing enough to protect Italy, because Italy is not going to deliver. I mean, you know, I remember, you know, as a student reading a book by A.J. P. Taylor, which had a wonderful footnote on about page 3, which said, except Italy. It said, it would be tedious to add these words to every generalisation about Europe. Henceforward, they can be assumed. And, you know, that is an endemic issue about Italy in Europe, I'm afraid. Europe has got a managing Italy problem, because it's a managing Berlusconi problem at the moment. He may not go on forever, however many facelifts he has, but somebody else will come along and preside over the same system. So it's a fundamental problem.
And so we've got, as Martin's reminding us there, 27 different shades of domestic politics to worry about in this. And then at the European-wide level, we have a bizarre situation where we have two different European presidents with slightly different titles, Van Rompuy and Barroso. I think I heard a whisper on the radio this morning that there might be a new president for the Eurozone. Does it feel like an environment where this very complicated plan that Raph's talked about is actually going to be enacted?
I think we're at an absolutely kind of critical juncture for the development of Europe, and the survival of the eurozone and the euro is absolutely critical to it. If it takes another president and it takes a growing together of the eurozone countries, then I suspect that's what we're going to have to live with. And I think what we will see is a kind of slow reforming of the rest of Europe round it.
I don't think you can avoid having that closer integration of the eurozone for precisely the reason that the markets, the ultimate backstop demand of the market is that Germany puts its economy up as collateral for southern European states and says, whatever it takes, there's so much political solidarity behind this mission that the relatively healthy and sort of stable budget of the German economy stands by the less stable, less healthy budgets of Greece and Italy. And for that to happen, you need to have a situation where politically the budgets, the financial management at the political level in southern Europe gets some kind of oversight from officials at the European Central Bank and in Germany. And if that means a German official having to sign off a Greek budget or an Italian budget, that's politically very, very unpopular, very difficult to do for all sorts of obvious historical reasons. But that seems to me that's what the markets want to see happen, to say this is actually a formidable, serious single currency.
But then Merkel said in the Bundestag yesterday that that was part of where we were going. So, I mean, you're absolutely right. I completely agree with that.
Two questions suggest themselves there. First of all, Raf, the politics and economics, Martin said, often point in different directions here. Do the people of the eurozone, forget Britain for the moment, but the people of the eurozone want this kind of closer integration?
Well, it's very hard. There are all sorts of reasons why, historical reasons, as I say, why Greece in particular doesn't like the idea of a German minister coming in on an aeroplane and telling them what their budget should be. And I think there are lots of European countries who, for cultural and historical reasons, find that challenging. I think the other side of that is the difficulty of even contemplating leaving the eurozone, because what would happen, it's very difficult to do it in an orderly way, because the moment you say, well, actually, maybe we don't need to be in the euro at all, and you know that your new, or rather your old currency is going to come back much weaker, everyone goes to the bank and draws out all their euros.
Suitcases of euros, yeah.
So that's an absolutely atrocious sort of concept to contemplate. But then the other point, going back to what Martin was saying, the difficulty of implementing at a national level some of the measures, the austerity measures that are required to get budgets in order, which are inevitably going to weigh down on growth in all of these debt-laden countries. And so you're talking about a decade of low growth, a decade of having your policies dictated from the European Central Bank. And we haven't even begun, I think, to see what the problems for political stability are going to be in these areas.
We keep writing that people don't care about Europe. My God, they ought to be caring about Europe. And we are facing the most a potentially catastrophic democratic stresses and strains in this process. And the idea that, as you say, we know how difficult it is domestically to impose the kind of deflationary policies that we're doing here and that Greece and Italy and the other countries have to face, and to have it imposed from outside seems to me to be completely untenable.
And absolutely crucially, sorry to interrupt, part of the process is privatisations. Now, we've had a load of privatisations in this country. Now, a lot of these other European countries are going to have to sell off state assets. Now, who's going to be buying those assets? Who's got capital? Well, it's the sovereign wealth funds that are owned by from the Gulf or from China. It's corporate institutions with a lot of money. So the idea that, as well as this process of low growth and stagnation, you're going to be transferring, as it were, the crown jewels of your national economy to who knows who, it's a recipe for serious political instability, I'd say.
So that's grim enough, and that's within the eurozone. But I think the second issue, Martin, and we got a sense of this maybe with the late night meeting that David Cameron convened of non-eurozone EU members, is whether you might have a second bloc opening up on Europe's periphery.
Well, I think the non-Eurozone EU members, of whom there are 10, including the UK, are quite a heterogeneous bunch. And one of the secondary things that I think is going to be quite interesting is whether or not this does develop some kind of cohesive common interest. My feeling is it probably doesn't, because many of those 10 would like to be members of the Eurozone if they could be, and for one reason or another they can't. The UK is rather different in that respect, because it chooses for a variety of reasons, economic, financial, political, cultural reasons, not to be part of the Eurozone. So I think Britain's in a rather different kind of odd, it's a big odd player, whereas I think most of the other 10 non-members of the Eurozone are, well, not all small, but they all by and large have aspirations to join the Eurozone in some set of circumstances
but,
or other.
But there is a kind of reconfiguration that's possible, isn't it, that would bring in perhaps other EFTA countries. There is a
European free trade agreement.
It is possible to imagine a kind of
European
separate,
economic area.
Yeah.
Kind of thing. Well, that exists already.
But it could have. But maybe that could be a more cohesive, and especially if it comes to negotiating repatriation of powers from the Eurozone countries.
I think this is where the Euroscepticism in Britain is absolutely vital, because it's very difficult to negotiate with these other non-Euro but European Union countries to build up an alliance when they come back to you and say, as I understand happens, well, how serious are you about this whole thing anyway? I'm not going to put together a negotiating position with you in the council if actually you're going to flounce out of the whole thing altogether in a few years' time.
Well, whether or not we're in for that sort of a two-speed Europe, most people told the Guardian ICM poll this week that they prefer a no-speed Europe, at least as far as Britain's concerned. They want to see it pull out entirely, or at least they say so at the moment. And it's that sentiment that saw over 100,000 people put their name to a petition which got Parliament debating Europe's future and Britain's relationship with it in this of all weeks. To debate the motion calling for a referendum on Britain's membership of the EU, it was William Hague, an erstwhile poster boy for the Eurosceptics, who found himself speaking against it during a whipped vote in the Commons. But Tory backbenchers were in rebellious mood.
When push comes to shove, getting a proper relationship with the European Union is more important than the coalition. And if the Liberal Democrats want to go to a general election saying, let's have more rules from Brussels, from Mr. Barroso, let them try it. And let them see how many seats they win on that basis. So it is for us backbenchers to say to Her Majesty's government, stiffen your sinews, summon up the blood, and imitate the action of a tiger. For that is how you should behave towards our European partners, not like bagpuss. Yeah.
Jacob Rees-Mogg there invoking Henry V, one of 81 Tories defying the whips on Monday and reopening the potentially ruinous split in the party. Well, Philip Cowley is a politics professor at Nottingham University and an expert on parliamentary rebellions. Earlier, I called him and asked him how this rebellion compares with others in history.
Huge is the short answer. It's the biggest European rebellion of either Labour or Conservative in the post-war era. And as someone pointed out to me when I made this point to them earlier this week, since there weren't any rebellions on Europe in the pre-war era because there was no issue to rebel on, you can legitimately say these were the biggest European rebellions ever.
Right, OK. And how does it compare to other rebellions on other subjects? You know, one thinks of Iraq and benefit cuts Tony Blair was trying to introduce and other things John Major was trying to do.
Well, it's not the largest rebellion on any issue, but it comes pretty close. If you take just Tory ones in government, and again go back to 1945, it tops all except a string of votes towards the end of the Major years, which were on gun control after the massacre at Dunblane. The largest of those included 95 Conservative MPs voting against the whip. But you take those votes out, and this is larger than any rebellion faced by any other Conservative Prime Minister. So it's larger than Mrs. Thatcher's, for example, which was 72 on the shops bill in 1986. So huge.
And is it part of a trend or is it a one-off?
Oh, no, it's definitely part of a trend. It's part of a trend in two ways. First, it's part of a trend if you go back and look at the general trend from 1945 onwards. You'll see that although there is this received wisdom that says that MPs used to be more independent, and now we've got these spineless creeps. Actually, the opposite is true. MPs are now becoming much more independent, much more likely to rebel against the party whip. And you see that parliament on parliament. This parliament is already the most rebellious in the post-war era.
So it's a long-run trend. And the interesting thing is, of course, this is an unusual situation in that there's a coalition government. The whips can't call on the Liberal Democrats in quite the same way as they can on the Conservatives, perhaps, or that, you know, it's an interesting question. And we're early on in the Parliament. So with 81 Conservative MPs and a few abstainers having at least blotted their copybook, with the whip's office. Is that going to make it harder for those whips to control them going forward?
Oh, the thing is, it's not just the 81 who rebelled this week that are the problem. If you take the rebellion this week and the others so far, you've got 116 who voted against the party whip in total, just on the conservative part of the government benches. You've then got a good chunk of the Liberal Democrats as well who voted against the whip, and we are not yet at the end of the first session. And one of the standard rules of parliamentary life, again, in most of the post-war era, is that the first session is usually less rebellious than the ones that follow, because it's the first session where the government is getting its early legislation through. People stay on message to begin with, and then they become more troublesome as we go on. So you've already got more than 100 who voted against the party whip on the Conservative benches, and these are 100 people who are going to carry on doing that.
Philip Cowley there. And for anyone who's been watching Conservative Party politics for any period of time, this might feel a bit like Back to the Future this week.
Yes, it certainly did, and I'm certainly joined the chorus saying so and writing so. I'm kind of slightly repenting my words, actually. I think it is really important. I think there's also a fundamental difference in the nature of this debate within the Conservative Party now and the one of 10 years ago. It's different in tone, it's different in style, and that's because the backbenchers are different as well as because the issue's different. And yes, there are still, Bill Cash is still there, and he does sound very much as he always did. But the mood overall is infinitely more Eurosceptic. There is no longer a body of people for whom supporting the activities of Europe is an article of faith, and that alters the entire nature of the conversation within the party.
So that's moved on. But Martin, when you get a rebellion on this scale, quite often it's not just to do with the subject under discussion. It's also to do with being a bit fed up with the leader, maybe, and the style of, their prospects or non-prospects of getting a job in a coalition.
Yeah, I think the most obvious reason why there is this revolt is obviously the Europe, which is a very powerful issue for the Tory party still, in whatever form it is. But the second is the coalition. There's an awful lot of Tory backbenchers who are in denial about the fact that they're in coalition. And they wish this was a Tory government, and they wish it would behave like a Tory government, but it doesn't because it can't, and this frustrates them. And of course there are more sort of particular things like the fact that they can't get preferment and promotion as easily as they might have done in others if it was a single party government, and the fact that they're fed up with being ignored by Cameron as they see it, the fact that the expenses regime is under such close scrutiny. There are all sorts of things that make them grumpy, and so as ever these things kind of come together. But I slightly disagree with Anne here. I think I completely agree that this is not the same argument as about Europe as was taking place in the past, because you never get into the same river. But nevertheless, it is an argument, I think, between those who powerfully believe that this issue overrides everything else and those who don't. And, basically it's a pragmatist versus fundamentalist argument. And it was that back in the 90s too. I mean, yes, there was more enthusiasm, as you might say. There were more supporters of Ken Clark back in the 90s, but there weren't that many. The John Major versus the Bastards battle was a battle between Major, the pragmatist, and the fanatics. And I think that's where we are now. And I mean, I think there's been a very interesting under-the-wire argument going on in the Tory party since Monday about what the meaning of all this is. And I've been particularly struck by a thing on Conservative Home by Lord Ashcroft, which I think is a devastatingly interesting piece, where he basically says this party is at risk of appearing to the electorate yet again as a party that is not in touch with the priorities of the voters. And, we've just got to get out of this mindset. And so, I think, and that's a big, strong echo of the 1990s. Maybe Ashcroft's wrong, but I think there's plenty of evidence, including polling evidence, for why he's right. I mean, look at there was an Ipsos Mori poll just in the last few days in which people were asked, what's the most important question facing Britain? 67% chose economic questions, 1% chose Europe.
But at the moment you put Europe and the economic issue together, and really it seems to me to be ridiculous to divorce the two because they are so closely interrelated, that then you've got a really potent mix on your hands, which actually, you know, I think has got to be kind of carefully addressed.
Well, can I just say I agree with that. And I think for the Tory party going forward, this is going to be really hard. And you get a lot of conversations with Tories at the moment about what's going to happen in the European elections in 2014, because they really are worried about that. They fear that UKIP will win the 2014 European elections and that will create a tremendous set of problems for the Tories as they approach the 2015 UK general election. That may be exaggerated, but the basic dynamic, I think, is probably right.
How big a problem for Cameron, then, do you think, Ralph?
I think it's big, and I think it's worth going back to the summer of around 2006 and remembering how Cameron's actually quite shaky start as leader of the party, when no one really understood what he represented and the big society theme hadn't quite taken shape, and even if it was taking shape, people weren't sure what it meant. And there was a moment where a lot of people in the Conservative Party were thinking, we sort of recognise that this man's quite presentable, but is he really a Conservative in the way that we'd like? And then as the tide turned and as Gordon Brown became Prime Minister and everything started to unravel for Labour, there was a tacit deal that was done with the party, which was from the point of view of the backbenchers saying, we don't really know what you're about, Mr. Cameron, but you look the part, and if you'll give us power, we'll shut up for a bit. And from Cameron's point of view, he said, well, look, trust me, because I know what it takes to get power. And when we get in, I'll give you at least some of what you want. And then as Martin
said, maybe a job.
Yes, and maybe a job. And as Anne Martin said, Cameron reneged on that deal by failing to win an open goal election. And I think there's a lot of repressed rage in the Conservative Party that they were told, if you shut up and let this man do what he thinks is the right thing to do, you'll be in for the first time in 13, 14 years. And it didn't happen. And they sort of can't quite understand what that means, except to say that suddenly now Cameron's giving things to the Liberal Democrats that by rights, in their view, are theirs. And that's a level of resentment and anger that it's very hard to see doing anything other than being destructive to David Cameron's premiership over time.
Well, with dark clouds then not only over Brussels, but also over Downing Street too, we'll draw things to a close for this week. So thanks very much indeed to Anne Perkins, to Martin Kettle and to Raphael Baer. And the producer was Phil Maynard. I'm Tom Clark, and thanks very much for listening.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.